Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Can I just ask?
Shut up, Evan.
I'm curious.
Could you shut up, Evan?
One thing I was thinking about.
Shut up, Evan.
So there are some rumors out there.
Evan, shut up!
Is it okay if I just ask?
Shut up, Evan.
Okay, but can I just...
Shut up, Evan.
I didn't even say anything.
Are we recording? Oh, we are good to go.
Okay. I mean, we're having a conversation. Where am I looking?
You're looking at me. We're having a conversation.
Okay. Okay, good. Now camera's on you.
But if I annoy you at any point and you're like, you don't want to make eye contact anymore, you obviously can cheat out. Good morning. Hi, Isaac. I'm beyond honored to have you here.
Thank you.
You know, I've been pursuing this interview for quite some time. We did a link up in like 2019 over the phone for Paper Magazine.
Exactly.
But then we saw each other recently and met in person for the first time, and then I was able to land you here, and you are just a huge part of my falling in love with the world of fashion. But I'm also a big fan of you in an interview setting as well, so I look forward to this, both to celebrate someone I admire, but also someone that I find really interesting as a human being.
I'm happy to be here and excited. And I'm glad we finally linked up.
Me too. I was doing my deep dive today, and it occurred to me that there's a very famous article that was written about you by Kathy Horn that appeared in the New York Times Magazine that is celebrating its 20th anniversary. February 2004 is when the article was first written. So 20 years ago, that article came out. I reread it today. It's a terrific piece of writing. You don't get, I was going to say fashion journalism. You don't really get a lot of journalism quite like that today. I want to get your response to that piece, but I wanted to read a section, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Just briefly.
Okay.
And again, this is the prolific Kathy Horn. The title of the article is a little bit adorable. In it, she writes, quote, "I thought then, and I think now, that Zach Posen is an operator. He's a little bit adorable and a little bit awful. Words I once used in reference to Arnold Scassi, there we go. Scassi, during his Bush fascination days. But I've also come to the conclusion that of all the young designers gathering on the horizon, Posen is the one who is most likely to break through precisely because he possesses all the same qualities that worked so beautifully for his predecessors in this venal industry. Success in fashion is one part talent, one part luck, and one part a tireless ability to hold a gaudy marquee over your head. Posen has all of these qualities in excess." That is remarkable to have written about you, but especially at the beginning of your career. How do you look back on that article? I know I have a feeling it stays in you.
I mean, that's good research. At that point in my career, I had already had a press, personal, and creative relationship with Kathy Horn for like 3 or 4 years, and, you know, was reviewed, fortunately, from my first runway collection. And on my first runway collection, not only did she give me a lot of space in print in the Times, she also critiqued front row of my show. And so it was this really interesting dialogue and rapport I had with her, because she was taking the clothing seriously. But it was also at the beginning of a real change in fashion that I was really attuned to in terms of how media was going to interact into the old system. Mm-hmm. And the system was about to change. It hadn't yet. I entered fashion at a time when serious journalism covered fashion. Having celebrities at your front row was a faux pas. Having theatricality on a runway show was like scary and challenging to the New York system.
Yes.
Having women of different age, of different heights, I mixed it all. And although there was a vision about an idea of building a company or a brand, it was survival, actually, and absolutely uncalculated and by the seat of our pants. So when this article happened, I don't believe I had taken a private equity investor yet. But to the front world, it seemed very star shining, which it was. But there was no serious financial backing at all. And it was pretty scary, was the reality. And so when that article came out, and I think it was just all way too overwhelming. I remember being like really angry and hurt by that article at the time. And the buildup to it, I'll just say, which is not online in the research, was that the New York Times had commissioned Alex Katz, the artist. I don't know if that's there to like paint my portrait.
No, but I know this story. Yeah, you were not pleased with that portrait. You like his landscape work, but you didn't like the work that
I didn't like this portrait of me particularly. I loved the experience with him. It was a strange portrait. It was a very smart article. I'd already kind of lived through many fashion hits, is what I would say at the time.
Well, it's interesting you mention that because in the Vogue review of your spring 2003 show, it begins by saying Zac Posen is entering the make or break stage of his career.
The stakes were high.
Yeah, but this is crazy because I think this is your second or third show.
Yeah.
And you have an esteemed publication like Vogue already speaking about this high wire act that you're on. Whereas you look at a lot of the young talent being cultivated today here in New York, and I think there's a care and a fragility in how they get spoken about in an effort to bolster them and help give them the lengthy runway before takeoff.
Well, I hope that's there for young creators.
It seems that way from my perspective.
I mean, I'm always singing the praises of creative incubation. I came to fashion from a very pure, creative place. It came from a place about women's character, and I fell in love with fashion through expression, cut of clothing, but also a theatricality of when I was entering fashion and what was happening in fashion at that time. 1996 was one of the greatest years of fashion. I mean, I was probably 16 or 15 at that time, and it was happening. I mean, you have John Galliano, Alexander McQueen at Givenchy. You have Vivienne Westwood doing some of her best work. Christian Lacroix, Olivia Teskin, Issey Miyake. And I was in New York starting to intern in fashion. I had made a transition from a choice of musical theater and had ended up in the costume shop. And that entered into fashion and crossed and blurring all that line. But that's what brought me into that. And I brought that back to New York. Mm-hmm. I'm going full circle how we're tying this back in here. And I went to Central St. Martin's in London and came to New York with this, which was not what New York fashion kind of at that moment had found its footing in this idea of a white catwalk. I was quickly zapped, in a sense. I would say very young in terms of my level of expression. Yeah, I mean, so when that article happened, it was really scary. I thought that was a make or break article. Mm-hmm. Kathy had a very important voice. And there definitely were personal jabs in there, but what retrospectively and many years after that of many reviews of Kathy and obviously a creative and professional rapport with her, you know, is understanding that she wouldn't even give it that kind of coverage if the work wasn't there.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of the takeaway now. And I think it's pretty poignant.
Absolutely poignant and a very great read.
I mean, we gave it a lot of room just now. But anyhow, interesting piece. I mean, that was an important piece in my life for a long time.
And I think it connects the dots in a lot of ways. And I think it almost seems so obvious to state, but so much of what you're speaking about from, you know, I believe, was it the first collection you did that was at the Lower East Side Temple?
Yes.
I mean, there was just a collection from New York Fashion Week this last season that showed at a synagogue and got a ton of press solely because of that location. Or when you were speaking about assembling celebrities at the front row. So much of what you were doing then is being done now to so much praise. In fact, it is the norm. If not the norm, it is the expectation.
Thank you. Been waiting for somebody to say that.
So on that note, speaking to, I think it's the spring 2003 show, okay, in attendance at that show, in the front row, was Julianne Moore, your friend Julianne Moore, and your friend Natalie Portman. Is it fair to call Natalie Portman a muse of yours at one point?
Absolutely. Okay, she's my Judy Garland. Work. I was her Mickey.
Flash forward to today, we have May December, these two stars that assembled 20 plus years ago at your show in this film. Have you seen May December?
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
I will.
Okay. I just found it so interesting. There are no photos of the two of them from that show. I dug deep to try
to find.
Oh, there
definitely are.
There are?
Yeah.
But I bring this up to say that you have these two Golden Globe nominees right now that are hot to trot. I mean, they always are, but they're having a huge moment right now. And you look back 20 plus years ago and where were they? They were at Zach Posen's show. And that was not out of the norm. This is where the celebrities assembled. I believe I heard you speak in an interview about Liza Minnelli attending one of your shows, coming backstage and saying to you, Mama would have loved this. That alone is iconography, but the fact that she felt that way, too, is iconography.
Yeah, that's kind of, I was kind of, that was it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a few key moments for me. I mean, definitely Liza Minnelli and an instant kind of understanding. I am deeply raised on her mom's music. You know, that started an understanding and a friendship.
Wow. Good friend to have.
The best.
When you started assembling these celebrities front row, they come backstage, you have the critics telling you you're amazing. You have so, not always, but often, right? You have the press. You have celebrities. I'm sure people on the street, etc. How did you metabolize so much feedback at that early stage of your career of people from the jump putting you on this pedestal? Obviously, I'm sure there's a lot of pressure from that, but how did it feel for you at the time?
Every day was a, you know, it was a new circus show. Every day was a photo shoot. Pretty much in the studio every day were major fittings for new collections being made, people coming through the studio. I mean, it was kind of, how did I process it? I just was in it, right? It was, it was continuous adrenaline of an amazing family that was in it with me, but that's also really grounding. But there was always the reality of the survival. You know, it was like living in theater. It was live theater. I became, at a really early age, pre-internet, like something that tabloids, like it entered that place. And that was really crazy too.
Yeah.
To understand, to reach that level. And I mean, that is not something I understood or expected, or, and it was, that was scary.
There's an article I found on the Intelligencer, I think it's from like 2009. I'm sure
that's later.
Right, but I'm sure you were just randomly pulled aside at a party or something, but it's like the headline is like, it's about you commenting on the sex in the windows at the Standard and like the visibility of people having sex.
Oh, I don't know. I probably was being provocative.
Yeah, but it's just an example of the fact that like any old thing becomes a headline, and that's not the case with just
I would
designer.
Be like in, I remember at the time I'd be in like the New York Post that I was like out at a nightclub dancing on tables, and I wouldn't be. I'd be like, I was like literally at home. And this was like consecutive. It would be like this kind of thing. Was there like a lookalike? I have to say, I think considering, my head was on pretty straight and tight. Like, I kind of understood the game, right? And I definitely have that performative, provocative side. And I knew how to play it. Like,
yeah, it's a theatricality.
It's a dance, a theatricality play of it. And if this was going to help support me build my creative vision and a business behind it, to also help support a community of people that I was building. Because I was building a real community of artisans in my studio that I was responsible for their livelihood.
Which is a big weight at any age, but especially so at such a young age. So, you know, you mentioned your head on straight and tight. At 21 years old, my head was not on straight and tight. I was here. I was going to Splash. I was going to Mary Poppins.
I wish I
on
had
Broadway.
Been.
Do you feel like you were able to have that formative time in your early 20s of going out? Like, did you have a non-work life at that time, or was the work so pressurized that it sort of took over that time of your life entirely?
No, I definitely did not have my 20s. I did not have the freedom that I think a lot of people have in their early 20s. And I think that I kind of was overprotective of myself.
Would you describe yourself as a serious person?
Oh, yeah. I'm really kidding me. I think I'm a serious person. That I'm very playful.
I was going to say, because I would describe you as a very
serious
person. You are intense. But you're also, there's a whimsy about you that is not present in a lot of people I typically ascribe seriousness around. So it's interesting.
Yeah, probably. I mean, you probably go into like some astrological sign thing of like what that is.
I was going to say, a lot of people with the astrological stuff, because I don't follow any of that, and I'll be somewhere sometimes and they'll ask me what I am and I'll tell them and they'll be like, oh, that's why you're whatever. And I'm like, don't put that on me. Like, you, I'm who I am.
Exactly.
You can do your charts, but don't tell me that. Like, and then they'll start to say, like, see patterns in my, and I'm like, okay.
The pattern.
Yeah, like, not that.
Okay, so that was some dip dive. What else?
Yeah, well, let's talk musical theater, though, because, you know, you mentioned your interest in costume design in theater, but I imagine at an even younger age, when you were first discovering musical theater, the art form itself really opened up to you. Let's start. Top five best musicals.
Whoa, that's impossible. Top five? I can't even pick them because there's for so many different reasons. Mm-hmm. Like, there's personal musicals. There's musicals I've watched, mm-hmm. right? Like roles I've played. I mean, my favorite role altogether was Artful Dodger. Started as an Oliver, ended up into Dodger, which was like a really fun role for me to play. Sunday in the Park with George is the first show I saw on Broadway on a matinee as a very young child. I probably slept through part of it, but I fell in love with Bernadette Peters. So that holds a very special part in my heart, as well as having a father who is a painter. And understanding from an early age through this show what I was experiencing from somebody who lived for their art and understanding that. So that really just in a very serious, on the serious side of stuff, really cut through.
I was going to say a serious show, but the character of Dot, she kind of injects some fun.
And tragedy and sadness and cutting. Like, but sure, there was definitely like a beautifully, kind of exaggerated turn of the century dress and, powder puff moment in a great corset.
The song Louis is quite fun.
It's fun and then dark.
You're right. Yeah, it's song like, I can't have what I want.
And so I walked out of that show and could recite the music and songs. And it was just in me. And that's when, I had that Sondheim cut through moment into my life, which was also followed by Into the Woods. And it was so beautifully designed. I mean, I always loved costume and set design. And what I would do, I would take all these shows, Little Night Music, and I would stage them with my cousins, with parents, with younger friends of mine. And I became the director, right? I was able to direct them. Or I would use my figurines and my Shira dolls and dress them up. And would make small maquette theaters in my room. And that's how I played. Like the turntable was the top of a fan. I had my scrims. The humidifier was the fog machine.
Okay, so no G.I. Joes for Zach Posen.
Not really, no. Unless they were like flea market, no.
Is there a costume in the canon of musical theater that for you is just... the girl. I'll give you a for instance, as you think. Yeah. I just saw this Stephen Schwartz concert, and so I've had Wicked on the brain. And I was just thinking recently, I mean, I obviously love the costumes in Wicked, but I particularly love the texture of Alphaba's final dress, the No Good Deed dress, when she's fully accepted her status as the Wicked Witch of the West.
Like the ruffles are in the right play.
And the way that costume hits the light. So I think Susan Hilferty did the costumes, Kenneth Posner did the lights.
Yeah.
The way that those lights are able to work with the costume, and then the changing of the light color changes the color of all of that to me. Is just
formative.
Yeah, I mean, I was a little older at that point, but
that's
like,
okay.
Okay, yes, adult formative.
As we said, like, it's okay.
Thank you.
I really think this is like,
this is permission.
It's permission to say that live art, filmmaking, like, as we talked about, like, early fashion shows and like the rules of the system, F them. Okay, are there formative moments for that? I mean, I think that Bernadette Peters as the reprise in the Ever After Act One finale of Into the Woods was like a really major moment. It's an off-the-shoulder, major, Bernadette in all her full, incredible figure. It was just like, that was it. It was 30s, 40s, Victoriana, fairy tale land. It had that same quality to me.
Okay. The depths of gay of this conversation
are
right
huge.
Now.
I also want to start one thing too. 80s, things were darker, right? Like, I'm raised on the Dark Crystal. And things were, like, scary. Like, scary kid stuff was real, and it was there. And that kind of macabre, glam genre really spoke to me.
Mm-hmm.
Wood, nymph, fairy wing, darkness. And that was part of our childhood. Mm-hmm. And that was very formative aesthetically.
Absolutely. Would you campaign to bring that era back?
I would. That campaign takes a big checkbook. Mm-hmm. Because okay. I don't think that that world can always be captured digitally anymore mm-hmm. by AI. You know, that world was very championed by great Imagineers, by the incomparable legend Jim Henson, hugely, who was very culturally influential. And that takes a great level of producers and studios investing in art department and investing in costume technique and building that actually physically, claymation, stop motion, creating fantasy imagination out of tangible things is something that I feel so fortunate to have been part of the end of that moment into the transition into digital. Same way I feel sad about like actual reviews.
Let's talk about investment in costumes and have that be the transition
sure.
into Feud, colon, Capote.
Yes.
Is it versus the Swans or V the Swans? I like saying V the Swans. I know it's versus.
It's versus, but we could say V the Swans. Could also be an and, but, you know, it's not.
Yeah, it seems very V from the episodes I've seen.
Love and hate are can be very close.
They can indeed. So this is the second season of Ryan Murphy's acclaimed anthology series. I want to focus in on episode 3, which was directed by the Gus Van Sant. Talk about formative for gays of our age. What a man. Written by the great John Robin Bates. And for those that don't know, this episode depicts what is known as the Black and White Ball.
Correct.
The Black and White Ball, which is a real event.
Also a very formative cultural event.
Also, random fun fact of connective thread here. I believe that Demi Moore, who appears in this show, is an old friend of yours, so much so that you have a colorway at one point that you named after her.
We do, Demi Moore Blue.
Demi Moore Blue.
Good research. A Neiman Marcus bestseller.
I don't doubt it.
It's deeper and richer than a cerulean.
Talk to me about how you got involved in this project.
Okay. I've known Gus since my early 20s. I first met him on one of my first trips out for the Oscars in LA. I met Ryan years ago, just kind of he wanted to meet me and wanted to know what I wanted to do and ideas of casting, you know, and he was just throwing it out there. And maybe my subculture, pop culture, love, you know, and maybe like both being like intense dreamer Scorpios, that connected there. And that was kind of it. And then 2 years ago, I guess now, or a year and a half ago, 2 years ago in the summer. Not last summer, the summer before. Gus, who I've had over the years became friends with, and I'm really a fan of him as a fine artist. And Gus said, I'm coming to New York. You know, I'd love to see you. I said, come for dinner. What are you doing here? I'm scouting for this show I'm thinking about doing about Truman Capote and his ladies at the time, the Swans. And, you know, I thought that's surprising. It's not like the subject matter that I immediately would associate with Gus. And immediately I said, well, if there's going to be gowns, and I didn't know what time period this was going to take place, right? I didn't know if it was going to be at the ladies. I didn't know it was Feud. You know, I said, if you're going to make Charles James gowns, like, please, I have time right now. I don't have my company. I don't design for Zach Posen and the brand. Like, I'm a one-man show. I can do this for you really well. I'd love to work with you. And then he said, Ryan. I said, love to work with Ryan. Then he kind of corrected me about the time period that the show was taking place, right? And I started going into my depth of research. You know, I love social history. I like this time period. These are great inspiration, these ladies of style, when kind of the old world met what we feel is contemporary today. It's a period of time that I think I probably would have existed fine in. So I started sending him these photos of Truman Capote really looking destroyed and really, you know, sad and insane, basically, with CZ Guest at Studio 54. And then I was like waiting. And then I saw Ryan. I ran into Ryan and I said, Ryan, like, I want to do this. And he said, well, let's have you do the Black and White Ball. And all of a sudden, I had like a week in a sense. I'd kind of been like lightly prepping, but then I was like, is this not going to happen? I don't want to get my hopes up. I don't know what the, you know, what is the menu going to be?
You like a food metaphor.
Well, I wrote a cookbook.
Makes sense.
I wrote a cookbook. So, yeah, of course. I mean, listen, we all eat.
Totally.
We all
didn't mean to derail.
That's okay. So that's kind of how, I mean, it really came from that idea, and I had assembled an enormous amount of research, and then I really had a week or two to kind of put together this proposal. I got called to set finally, and I had gone into real deep research. I mean, one bio to the next bio to the next one, and the stories are totally different and start to change. So it's like, how do you collect as a researcher history? What was apparent was that this was the really first large media covered social event that combined whoever Truman decided he wanted to invite, which were who was important socially that he, in his world that respected him, and then just people he thought were interesting in Hollywood. It was all mixing. It was also televised. And I was able, through this experience, through a friend of a friend, found a VHS of the entrances of the ball, which I brought to production. And I just went like crazy. I went down to matching fabrics, going into like the last silk flower place in New York, you know, trying to find the research of what, you know, hats or masks Roy Halston would have made for this. And then I had to interpret each lady and character that was given to me. I kind of did this through 2 or 3 days of like sourcing, right? Because I kind of sketched three-dimensionally. He wanted illustrations of like these fashion illustrations. And I said, why don't I just like build you half of each of these looks, right? And because I think that's a really interpretation. So I did that, and it was like, you know, it's like three-dimensional draping and collage, because I just like to get my hands dirty and like build. And that's really, you ask like what brings me happiness or peace, or you haven't yet, but you might later.
Do you want me to?
I'll answer it for you. And that's that. I'm in my creative moment when I have my music going and my pins are flying in scissors. That's where I feel good, truly, same way as like when I'm cooking. And that's my comfort, happy place. And so I presented them like 2 days after Thanksgiving. I kind of did a presentation. I had a projection of swans swimming by on water over these drapings. And each one, you know, was there. It was Calista as Lee Raswell. It was Naomi as Babe. It was Chloe as CZ and Molly and Demi and all the ladies. I don't think I'm forgetting any.
Diane Lane.
And Diane Lane as Slim Keith.
By the way, like a moment just for the assemblage of this star power in this show.
It was unbelievable. So I had padded the mannequins all to their measurements or carved away when needed to, right? Because I think let's start on their body forms, because my process is I drape these and then I pass them off. And then Ryan came in and said, well, you know, he loved them. And he said, but I didn't hire you to recreate history. And I thought, what? And he said, this has to be elevated. This is not a historical recreation show. I thought, oh my gosh, you know what I'm going to do? And it was the greatest creative challenge moment that I've had in a long time. And it was great. And so I had to kind of rethink of this and like up it and think about modern day expectation of theatricality and understand the balance between this being, yes, in a historic setting and wanting to feel respectful and in sync to the guidance and direction productionist sets. Gus World, these incredible actors on their own, who a lot of them I have very long-standing relationships with and understanding their relationship and role to costuming, and then it being Ryan Murphy's ball, in essence, within Truman Capote's ball, within that world, and finding that balance, I knew that I was like that person in that moment. And so I delved even deeper into it and found this fine balance between history and places where these historic ladies' outfits weren't recorded historically. And I'm forgetting one very important component here, which is Ryan put a camera on me and said, let's document this process of the making of these dresses. And so he made these short format documentary of the making of these costumes that will come out in some format with the show.
Good. I think that's important because, sort of landing the plane here to our earlier discussion of your seriousness as a human being, it's that same seriousness that you bring to your work. And I think it's why so many people connect to you and the work that you've provided us with these last couple of decades. and that seriousness, you know, you mentioned the research, but even talking about, you know, rather than sketching, presenting these 3D models and then starting with the actresses and draping around them. All of this thought pattern is not evident in so much of the landscape today. And so I think I want to both highlight and celebrate the fact that
you
exist and that we have you. And also I want to tip my hat to people like Ryan Murphy and Gus Van Sant who understand your vision and understand the importance of helping to execute that vision.
It was a huge opportunity.
Yes.
I mean, Gus and Ryan, pretty cool, I have to say.
Yeah.
And like, and Lou too.
Yeah, but you're pretty cool.
One goes in and out of waves of popularity within a public career, right?
Yeah.
And hits your high or low. I mean, this is part of it, right? And that's also what makes it exciting. It's part of American culture. It's part of kind of media and Hollywood. And that's something that I, in the historical place, really thrive off of. And Ryan does too. And it's pretty cool for him to give me this amazing platform and opportunity and to have the guidance of Lou in there as well. Mm-hmm. And knowing that it's going to be through kind of the cool lens and sophisticated lens of Gus with incredible writing with friends. I felt, because costuming and glamour and creation of that is so important at this pinnacle moment.
Yes.
I mean, people say Truman Capote, they know Breakfast at Tiffany's and they know The Black and White Ball. Those are, you know, and if they're literary, they know In Cold Blood. But there's a deeper depth to that. And so I felt like there was a really, this was like a really big task at hand. I'm also friendly with Anne Roth. And Anne Roth had worked on costumes of a Truman film where the black and white ball, sadly, was totally cut out. She worked on this ball scene. So I just knew there was like deep history within the recreation of this ball. It's part of cultural zeitgeist, and I think that was interesting, and mythology.
Absolutely.
And the truth of the matter is, apparently, it was a real bore.
I feel like often a lot of hype things.
I mean, I think the Italians, Mirella Agnelli, who's not in the show as a character, that's why when we say, like, there's elements here or not, you know, it was like, uh-uh, they were out. They were like, they flew in, they did the big dinner before. People had, like, pre-parties for this. They hint at that in the show, right? Like, what a boring party at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Or felt stiff. Or hard, you know, not a, whatever.
Yeah.
We had fun. Seeing that scene being filmed on set is something I'm going to take with me for the rest of my life. The build up to it in like a week and a half to 2 weeks of these fittings with these incredible artists was really formative. Major changes were made on garments. The drama was there. I don't feed into that drama in those moments. I am try to be very creatively quick on my toes. And I am here to make a performer feel their ultimate confidence and know when to be able to push them in levels of theatricality and make them feel comfortable in it. This has to function, even if it's for a split second on set. And that was really fun. These could have been a fashion show. And maybe it is. We'll see.
We will see. I didn't get to talk about the Met Gala. I didn't get to talk about House of Z.
We can do it quickly. We can do
I do want to, let's end on this.
Met Gala has been my own black and white ball for many years. Like that's been, I feel, you know, I was an intern at the Met. It's close to home. I feel very part of the history of the making of that, for good or for bad, for what it's become.
I think for good
because, you know,
different conversation.
But I love that this ups, you know, people can roll their eyes. You know, and I think grease paint and a costume that links between high fashion, absurd, why not? I mean, maybe it will look like, you know, the end of Rome one day to look back at it. But maybe there's great creative moments that spark imagination in somebody looking at that, even if it's on Instagram or on a scroll or social media. And I know that I've had some moments in my career that have done that. And then that is what I live for.
Yeah, you've had quite a few.
Okay.
But on that, I just want to end. So, you know, you mentioned your cookbook earlier,
yep.
right? We're talking about the costume design you're doing with Capote now. And this is in addition to so many other sort of, I don't know if you want to call them side ventures that you've had throughout your career. I'm thinking about creative director of Brooks Brothers, designer of the uniforms for Delta Airline, judge on Project Runway, designer of a collection for David's Bridal. So there are so many sort of ways in which your career has deviated from the norm of a fashion designer, which is, I think, kind of the most exciting place to be.
I'm feeling very recognized. on this talk. Thank you.
We're in 2024 right now.
Yeah.
And so as we look ahead and we start to say, okay, you've checked off all of these boxes of things you maybe never even imagined and came to be. Is there something if you wanted to put out there? Because I'm not into Zodiac, but I am into energy.
If you were
to energetically put something out here for the year. And I have to say, in this time with you, there's a lot of energy that you possess right now. I feel you are in a very powerful place. I'm not putting this on. This is how I feel about you. I felt it about you when I saw you several months ago as well. I gravitate towards that energy. What are we putting out there?
We're putting out there to change the world.
And on that, thank you.
Shut up, Evan. Shut up, Evan. Shut up, Evan.
Shut Up, Evan is produced by me, Evan Ross Katz, with audio editing by Sophia Asmuth and social media by Griffin Dunn. Shout out to our Patreon subscribers for their financial support, and thank you to you all, the listeners, for helping us keep the lights on.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.